Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to begin an update on the assassination of President Kennedy. There have been a number of journalistic developments over the last several years pursuant to the release of the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, and a flurry of legislative attempts, some of them successful, at obliging U.S. government officialdom to release any of the information that had not been released to date. As I said, those efforts have been partially successful, and Oliver Stone's efforts have been extremely successful, at least in drawing people's attention once again to the assassination of President Kennedy. And there has been no shortage of new journalistic developments vis-a-vis the investigation, albeit 33 years now, or almost 33 years after President Kennedy's assassination. I'm recording this, by the way, on June 20th of 1996, for those who eventually hear this program on tape. Research credit on this first article goes to a listener, and this article concerns the alleged recruitment of a Green Beret back in the mid-1960s to murder William Pitzer, who was a lieutenant commander at Bethesda Naval Hospital and one of the individuals involved in the Bethesda Hospital autopsy, or alleged autopsy might be a better way of putting it, on President Kennedy. This former Green Beret, a fellow named Dan Marvin, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, maintains that he was recruited along with a colleague of whom there is no official record, at least according to U.S. military records, to kill Mr. Pitzer. According to Dan Marvin, this Green Beret, the alleged attempt at recruiting both Marvin or and or a colleague, Mr. Vanek or Vanek, V-A-N-E-K, to kill William Pitzer was under the auspices of William Pitzer being a traitor who was disseminating information or selling information, quote, secrets, unquote, to the enemy. We now know, of course, this was not the case. And the former Green Beret, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, didn't think much of this particular attempt at recruitment or alleged attempt at recruitment by an unnamed CIA fellow. But years later, while watching a PBS special on the Kennedy assassination, an accounting of the names, or a recounting of the names of people who had been associated with the case and had died violently was listed. And then Dan Marvin saw the name of William Pitzer, the man in charge of the Kennedy autopsy records at Bethesda. Here's the story of what may be yet another chapter in the official investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. As far as I know, the story told by Dan Marvin has never been confirmed or denied. Of course, the fact that Lieutenant Commander Pitzer turned up dead on alleged suicide certainly reinforces the credibility of this account. Of course, it does not confirm it. Research credit, once again, on this goes to a listener. This is from the Ithaca Journal of November 16th, 1995, specifically from the Ithaca Journal, the City and Towns section of the Ithaca Journal. It's listed on page 3A, according to this annotation. The article is by Franklin Crawford, C-R-A-W-F-O-R-D, of the Ithaca Journal staff. It's headlined, "Local Man Tells JFK Story," subtitled, "History Channel Includes Marvin in Six-Part Series." It may just be his story, or it could be history. In either case, retired Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin's relationship to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy is intriguing. His association with the assassination story that won't die is revealed during a national TV broadcast Sunday night. Marvin, a former Green Beret trained in guerrilla warfare, assassination, and terrorist tactics, appears in the History Channel's coming documentary, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, The Truth Shall Make You Free. The last of a six-part series produced by Nigel Turner, the one-hour TV broadcast airs at 9 p.m. Sunday and again at 9 p.m. November 24th. In it, Marvin, an Ithaca resident, relates his account as a Green Beret on, quote, the periphery of the Kennedy assassination, unquote. Speaking to the Journal on Tuesday, Marvin recalled an afternoon in 1965 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where he and another Green Beret were summoned to meet a, quote, company man, unquote, someone from the Central Intelligence Agency. Marvin said the company man, standing under a group of pine trees, quote, asked if I would terminate William B. Pitzer, unquote, a lieutenant commander at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, because he was selling secrets to the enemy. The name meant nothing to Marvin at the time, and initially Marvin said he agreed to the assignment. But moments later he refused when he realized Pitzer was to be, quote, terminated, unquote, on American soil. That was something Marvin understood to be a no-no for special forces operatives like himself. Quote, I refused the mission once I was told it was in the U.S., he said, adding that the company then spoke to Marvin's colleague, a Captain David H. Vanek, or Vanek, V-A-N-E-K. Marvin said he doesn't know what happened between Vanek and the company man, but today he can find no information on Vanek, whom he hasn't seen since that day under the pines in 1965. Marvin produced a letter of inquiry with Vanek's name and military identification number to the U.S. Military Records Division in St. Louis, Missouri, and its response. There is no record of a Captain David H. Vanek. The plot thickened for Marvin in 1993 when he was watching a PBS special on the Kennedy assassination. Toward the end of the show, 42 names of people associated with the Kennedy case who died violently were listed. Among them, William B. Pitzer, the man in charge of the Kennedy autopsy records at Bethesda. Quote, when I saw that name, I about got sick in my living room, unquote, Marvin said. Pitzer died in his office at Bethesda Naval Hospital in 1966, and the official record of his death lists it as a suicide from a gunshot wound. Marvin has been in contact with Pitzer's wife, Joyce Pitzer, and has two recorded phone conversations with her. She was unable to get her husband's autopsy for 28 years. I think it should have been autopsy records. For 28 years, Marvin said. It is Marvin's personal recollections combined with his subsequent personal investigations into the Pitzer connection, which he says had been stymied by his wife's lawyer, that brought him into the History Channel documentary. More than 30 years later, the Kennedy issue is unresolved for Marvin, who says he wants, quote, just the truth. That's what we're shooting for, unquote. He is not alone. Marvin's greatest advocate throughout his quest for truth is Robert Palmer, the local cable access producer. He's the only one who stuck by me, Marvin said. And then it goes on to promote that particular special. Again, this is from the Ithaca Journal of November 16, 1995, page 3A, Local Man Tells JFK Story, subtitled History Channel Includes Marvin in Six-Part Series. It's by Franklin Crawford. Again, summing up, this article tells the story of then-Lieutenant Colonel, or eventually Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin in the Green Beret, who maintains that he was contacted by a CIA man, a CIA officer, and that along with a colleague, a Captain David H. Vanek, or Vanek, V-A-N-E-K, about whom there is no official record in U.S. military records, company man, quote-unquote, attempted to recruit them to kill a William Pitzer because he was supposedly selling secrets to the enemy. In fact, William Pitzer was apparently in charge of the autopsy records for the Kennedy assassination autopsy, or the second autopsy that took place at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Later, Marvin was watching a documentary about the Kennedy assassination, and in a listing of 42 names of people connected with the case who had died violently, he came across Pitzer's name, and at that point, that reopened for him that entire experience. And as Marvin puts it, he just about got sick. Marvin initially refused the assignment because he accepted the assignment, then refused it when he realized that Pitzer was to be terminated on American soil, a no-no for an active duty Green Beret. There is no explanation provided here for the reason why Captain Vanek's name does not appear in official military records. Eventually, Pitzer died of a gunshot wound. He was listed as a suicide, and apparently his widow had been unable to obtain his autopsy records for some 28 years. So, with former Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, the Kennedy assassination investigation, at least, winds or grinds onward. A new detail concerning FBI's attempts at keeping track of Lee Harvey Oswald well before he became a household name was recorded in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, December 9th of 1995. The following is a Reuters story at Stateline, Washington. It's headlined, FBI Asked Swiss Police to Help Track Oswald in 1960. The article reads as follows. 3 years before President Kennedy was assassinated, the FBI asked Swiss police to help track defector Lee Harvey Oswald, FBI documents released Thursday showed. Swiss police, at the FBI's request, investigated whether Oswald had followed through on a stated plan to attend Albert Schweitzer College in Cherwalden, Switzerland, or whether an impersonator might have taken his place, the records showed. The answer to both questions was no, the Swiss concluded. Oswald, a former U.S. Marine who defected to the Soviet Union in 1959, was arrested in Dallas hours after shooting Kennedy, it should have been after allegedly shooting Kennedy, on November 22, 1963. Oswald was shot dead by nightclub owner Jack Ruby 2 days later. In a hotly disputed finding, the presidentially appointed Warren Commission concluded in 1964 that Oswald, acting alone, killed Kennedy. But a House investigative panel concluded in 1979 that Kennedy was probably the victim of a conspiracy, and some researchers maintain any such plot would have involved one or more Oswald impersonators. By the way, I'm one of those in agreement with that. There were Oswalds, or people calling themselves Lee Harvey Oswald, turning up all over the American Southwest, doing all sorts of things that subsequently incriminated Lee Harvey Oswald. Continuing with the article, the newly released documents involve FBI contacts with Swiss police after Oswald renounced his U.S. citizenship at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow October 31, 1959. The Assassination Records Review Board in Washington is compiling records related to Kennedy's assassination. The FBI learned of Oswald's plan to study in Switzerland from his mother, who received the school's acceptance letter addressed to him at her home in Fort Worth, Texas. In an October 12, 1960 memorandum to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Paris quoted the Swiss police as saying Oswald never turned up at the school and it was unlikely he had matriculated under a different name. The memo also said there was no record of, quote, a person possibly identical with the subject being registered for the semester that began October 2, 1960. But a November 3, 1960 follow-up memo quoted Swiss police as reporting Oswald sent a $25 deposit toward tuition in a letter dated June 19, 1959. So as to exactly what Oswald was doing at that school, whether there was an Oswald impersonator who matriculated there, or whether someone else calling himself Lee Harvey Oswald might have been doing other things, is not finally resolved, but there certainly is no official record concerning Lee Harvey Oswald and that alleged impersonator who may have impersonated him at that school, if in fact such a thing happened. I personally am not concerned with whether or not Oswald or a double went to that school, but rather there were people identifying themselves as Lee Harvey Oswald turning up all over the American Southwest in the months leading up to President Kennedy's assassination, including during times when Lee Harvey Oswald was proven to be elsewhere other than where these alleged Oswalds were turning up. And many of the behaviors they engaged in, or many of the things they did, subsequently went to make Lee Harvey Oswald appear to be the assassin that he was alleged to have been. It's also worth noting, however, that the FBI was taking interest in this alleged defector to the Soviet Union. I personally, along with many other researchers, feel that Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. intelligence operative and that his, quote, defection, to unquote, to the Soviet Union was engineered by whatever intelligence agency was running him. However, I do think that these documents that the FBI released are significant. It indicates that the FBI was taking an abiding interest in Lee Harvey Oswald years before he became the alleged assassin of President Kennedy, and in light of the kid glove treatment that was accorded Oswald by the National Security Establishment in the period between his return from the Soviet Union and his arrest for allegedly assassinating President Kennedy, although he was never charged with that, I think the kid gloves treatment accorded Lee Harvey Oswald demands closer scrutiny than it has received to date. By the way, for information about the Kennedy assassination, there are numerous archive shows available from Archives on Audio, including the Guns of November series, a number of installments of Radio Free America program number 37, RFA 15, and a number of miscellaneous archive shows dealing with the Kennedy assassination. Either at the end of this segment or at the end of the next half-hour segment, I will have some information about Archives on Audio. The movie JFK by Oliver Stone, of course, was based on the investigation of President Kennedy's assassination that was conducted by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. In a recently concluded six-part interview with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, we once again touched on some of the New Orleans goings-on vis-a-vis Lee Harvey Oswald and the setting up of Oswald to look like a communist communist assassin who had killed President Kennedy. The Garrison probe, which inspired the movie JFK, the Garrison probe, which was to a considerable extent confirmed by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which recommended to the U.S. Department of Justice that, among other things, they begin an investigation of David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. That was who Jim Garrison was originally after. It was Garrison's ultimate vindication, despite all of the abuse that has been heaped upon Jim Garrison by the mainstream press and even the so-called alternative media. It's one of the reasons why I call them so-called. The Garrison probe, once again, has emerged in the news, and an account of that was carried in the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, February 14th of 1996. The following is an Associated Press story, Dateline New Orleans, and headlined, Documents Surface from Garrison Probe, subtitled, Jury Transcripts Get Their Custodian Thrown in Jail. So still, even in February of 1996, the Garrison Probe is making news and still causing controversy. This article reads, As if the Kennedy assassination probe didn't have enough twists, here's a new one. A former investigator on the case has been thrown in jail for packing up secret grand jury transcripts in his trunk, keeping them hidden for 21 years, and then turning them over to a federal panel. Gary Raymond, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, was taken into custody Tuesday after a judge gave him the maximum 6-month term for violating state grand jury secrecy laws. He was later released on bail pending an appeal. Raymond once worked for former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who believed CIA hardliners had had President Kennedy assassinated in 1963 to keep the United States in Vietnam. In 1969, Garrison put businessman Clay Shaw on trial on charges of conspiring to kill Kennedy. The jury heard 34 days of testimony, then deliberated less than an hour before acquitting Shaw. By the way, what is not related here is that the jury concluded there had been a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. They just could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was involved. It is also known now that Jim Garrison's investigation and his investigation into Clay Shaw was deliberately frustrated by elements of the U.S. intelligence community. Continuing with this article, again, from the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, 2/14/1996, shortly after Harry Connick succeeded Garrison as district attorney in 1974, Connick ordered Raymond to destroy the records of Garrison's grand jury proceeding. Instead, Raymond put the files in his trunk, then kept them hidden for 21 years. He wasn't sure what to do with them until Connick told the Federal Assassination Records Review Board last June that the files had disappeared when Garrison left office. Quote, Not only is the man lying about these records, but he is trying to pin it on Garrison's people, unquote, Raymond said. Raymond went to WDSU-TV reporter Richard Angelico, A-N-G-E-L-I-C-O, with the files and asked him to pass them on to the review board. Angelico did, but also went on the air with the names of the people who had testified 2 decades ago. Criminal District Judge Frank Marullo, M-A-R-U-L-L-O, who cited Raymond, said he would decide next week whether to hold Angelico in contempt. Raymond said he had gone to Angelico only because the reporter knew whom to contact on the review board. He said he had known nothing of Angelico's plan to report on the transcripts. The Federal Review Board now has the records and wants to release them, but is waiting for the courts to clear up their legal status, said board spokesman Tom Samoluk, S-A-M-O-L-U-K, and I may be mispronouncing some of these names. This article, in short, deals with the grand jury transcripts and grand jury records that pertain to Jim Garrison's investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. Harry Connick, by the way, the father of Harry Connick Jr., the well-known singer, ordered the records of Garrison's grand jury proceedings destroyed, but Gary Raymond, one of Garrison's investigators, instead kept them locked up in his trunk. Connick, apparently, according to this article, told the Assassination Records Review Board last June, that would have been, by the way, in June of 1995, that the Garrison grand jury files had disappeared when Garrison left office. This apparently incurred the wrath of Gary Raymond, who accuses Harry Connick, the New Orleans DA, of lying, and also says that he was trying to shift the blame to Garrison's people. Again, that according to Gary Raymond, as quoted in this article. Raymond next went to WDSU-TV reporter Richard Angelico with the files and asked him to pass them on to the review board. Angelico did, but also went on the air with the names of the people who had testified two decades ago. That certainly will not do much for secrecy concerning the ongoing investigation. It remains to be seen whether District Court Judge Frank Marullo, who cited Raymond, will hold Angelico in contempt. So at this point, the exact status of the records of Jim Garrison's grand jury investigation into Lee Harvey Oswald in the New Orleans area and into the Kennedy assassination, the exact status remains to be determined. There was, however, just this past week, a development that should be viewed as positive for those who would like to be able to glean any information that is valuable from those grand jury records. The Los Angeles Times of Monday, June 17th of 1996, carried the following short article in its Nation in Brief section. This is Dateline Louisiana, and it's headlined, Judge Orders DA to Give Up JFK Files. A federal judge has ordered New Orleans District Attorney Harry Connick to turn over records on President Kennedy's assassination to a U.S. government agency. The ruling caps a bitter dispute between Connick and the U.S. Assassination Records Review Board, responsible for screening assassination documents and making public those that do not endanger national security. Connick argued that he should not be compelled to surrender documents gathered by his predecessor, the late Jim Garrison. Garrison's family, however, voluntarily handed over to the review board other assassination documents kept in his personal files. So a federal judge has now ordered, according to this article, New Orleans DA, current New Orleans DA Harry Connick, to turn over those records to the Assassination Records Review Board. One of the problems with the review board is that any documents that are deemed to be important to national security can be withheld from the public, and they are apparently giving various U.S. intelligence agencies veto power, in a sense, concerning what might damage national security. However, that glitch, I guess one could say, notwithstanding, it is encouraging to at least see some progress being made on some of the relevant documentation that is still being withheld concerning Kennedy's assassination, and I personally am very glad to see the Garrison grand jury records now at least potentially being released for public consumption. I have always felt that Jim Garrison got a very, very bad rap indeed with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy and his very heroic investigation into same. He was basically destroyed. In our next segment or two, we're going to be going back once again into the circumstances surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. We will be focusing at considerable length on the painting of Oswald red. We will be discussing CIA connections to Oswald. I do not personally believe that the CIA engineered the assassination of President Kennedy. However, I do believe that there were elements of the CIA involved, but at that time that they were involved, I believe they were dancing to the tune of a different master, I guess one could say. In fact, those elements of the CIA that appear to have been involved in Kennedy's assassination fell well to the right of the CIA as a whole. Again, I do not believe the CIA ordered the assassination of President Kennedy. I believe there were, as I said, elements of it involved, but they were operating on behalf of other agencies or other powers, well to the right of the CIA as a whole. I alluded to archive shows. Those are a form of radio documentary that I've put together over the years, in which the printed sources upon which my lines of argument are based are presented, literally read on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. These archive shows are available, as I say, from a tape duplication service. More on that tape duplication service right now.
All of Dave Emery's archive shows are available from a tape duplication service named Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. Again, Archives on Audio can be reached at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, 94117-0023. The phone number, 415-346-1840. There is also a catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each show, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. The Archives on Audio catalog is available on the KFJC webpage, which is reached at http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. Again, the website, all lowercase letters, is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. The website also has a suggested reading list and a list of other sources to pursue for more information on this field of research. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC gets money from this arrangement.
KFJC-FM, by the way, is the home base station on which I record these, or at which I record these programs. The half-hour segments that I've produced, including this, are not available from Archives on Audio. They're available from a different service called Spitfire. That's Spitfire. Their address is Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. You can also contact them via email at alcalame@ix.netcom.com. Okay, that for Spitfire. They have the half-hour segments available. Those are not available from Archives on Audio. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.